Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Scandinavia, of all places, the news nerve center of the world this week. The President's Nobel in Oslo, Copenhagen climate talks, and back in the USA, bonus talk, war talk, and healthcare in the spotlight. President Obama accepted his Nobel Peace Prize with a notable nod to war.
Whatever mistakes we have made, the plain fact is this. The United States of America has helped underwrite global security for more than six decades with the blood of our citizens and the strength of our arms.
In Copenhagen, sparring over the changing climate between rich and poor nations and island nations like Tuvalu, threatened by rising seas, were making noise. And Democrats in Congress reach for a deal on health care. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she's ready to do what it takes.
I think we would do almost anything if it meant it would pass a health care for all Americans for the Christmas holidays.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your thought on the president's war talk at the Peace Prize ceremony? How are you seeing the rich-poor split in Copenhagen, the compromise brewing in Congress on health care? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Ron Brownstein, columnist for the National Journal and political director for Atlantic Media. Ron, great to have you back with us.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, Ezra Klein, reporter and blogger for The Washington Post. Ezra, a big welcome back to you as well, sir.
How are you, Tom?
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine, is with us. Hello, Jack. Great to have you.
Hello, Tom, Ron, and Ezra.
Let's go straight to President Obama's speech in Oslo, if we may. And I've got a chunk of it to listen to here, if I can ask your patience. I think it's worth before we dive in. He was pretty sober and telling the Peace Prize gathering there, we will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes.
There will be times when nations, acting individually or in concert, will find the use of force not only necessary, but morally justified. I make this statement mindful of what Martin Luther King Jr. said in this same ceremony years ago. Violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problem. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. As someone who stands here as a direct consequence of Dr. King's life work, I am living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence. I know there's nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the creed and lives of Gandhi and King. But as a head of state sworn to protect and defend my nation, I cannot be guided by their examples alone.
At the Peace Prize ceremony, the President of the United States cannot be guided by Martin Luther King and Gandhi alone. He went on to say, I face the world as it is and cannot stand idle in the face of threats to the American people. For make no mistake, evil does exist in the world. Ron Brownstein, what did you make of this president's speech? Very sober faces in that audience as well. This was not a peace celebration exactly.
Well, I'm not sure anyone would complain if you played the whole speech for the whole hour and had us just listen, because it really was a terrific speech. I mean, there are obviously limitations of what any speech itself can mean, and its impact in the real world. But as an expression of Obama's view of the world, one that both accepts the unique role of America as a guarantor or as a provider of international security, but also it departed from, I think, President Bush and much Republican thinking by emphasizing that we are stronger when we are working with others, when our power is channeled through international institutions, and at the same time also balancing both the ideal of nonviolence with the reality of an imperfect and dangerous world in a very Niebuhrian way, one of his favorite philosophers. It was an extraordinary performance, as he has, I think, done at other times as well. Now, you know, when you get from a speech into the real world and the choices get messy on how to deal with Iran and how long to stay in Afghanistan, that's another question. But in terms of framing a coherent view of the world and how America interacts with it, I think this was a speech that justifiably attracted a broad commendation from a wide range of the political spectrum.
A philosophical speech, a practical world-as-it-is speech. I couldn't help wondering, Ezra Klein, though. I mean, we've just come out of the 20th century, less than a decade ago, a century famously of war, but also of very high ideals around peace. Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi. Is this a retreat from that kind of idealistic vision of peace, Ezra?
You know, I wouldn't say so. What really struck me about the speech was how much Obama was defining who he is, right? And in particular, who he isn't. He was sort of saying to his base and his fans, both domestically and globally, I think, that I am leader of the country now. I'm not a candidate. I'm not a symbol. I am not a global harbinger of a new era. I have a job to do. And that was what really struck me about it, that what Obama was almost doing there was responding to the type of emotions that had gotten him that Peace Prize and saying, you're going to have to recalibrate your expectations of me because I'm going to have to do my job. And it can't be all of the different jobs. It can't be both the symbol that got me the Peace Prize and the president who leads this country through a time when, you know, many of the decisions that need to be made will be, you know, hard and messy and dirty and compromised. And that I thought was actually I think it's been a bit undercovered, but it was a really fundamentally mature speech in that way, not on Obama's part, but on the expectation he had of his audience. I mean, he came to them and he said, it's time for you and I to have something of a new relationship here.
Jack Beatty, did you see a step back from the ideal of peace in that, you know, let's get real kind of heart to heart?
I think there was some of that, and I think he was trying to square that logical circle by invoking Dr. King and what he owed to Dr. King. But what I was struck with was the retreat from what he said in the campaign, where he talked about dumb wars, and he said, I'm for smart wars and not for dumb wars. And he really was defending the idea of, you know, wars that further the national interest. He rightfully spoke of the damage that wars do and invoked at the same time the justice of a cause, but he didn't speak to the wisdom of wars. I mean, he went on to say, in today's wars, many more civilians are killed than soldiers. The seeds of future conflict are sown, economies wrecked, civil societies torn asunder, children scarred. Well, that's a description of what's going on in Afghanistan, it seems to me, and it raises gravely the question of whether a war, yes, a just war, a war can be just but not wise. It can be justified in terms of self-defense and still imprudent. And I miss that note in the speech, the note of realism that I heard in the campaign.
Ron, here's a question. You point out he is a sitting president with all those responsibilities receiving the prize this week. It was a philosophical speech. But I wondered, was it also a political speech? I was kind of praying that he wasn't playing to this audience or that audience, that he was telling it as he really saw it, as he really believes it. But did you hear a political speech as well there, positioning himself maybe, so as not to be vulnerable to charges of some mamby-pamby peace speech in Oslo?
Well, I think from the beginning, from the very announcement of the award, this has been the note they have struck. It would, you know, it's not unreasonable to see some political element in there, in the sense of Obama not wanting to allow himself to be defined as someone who is unusually averse to using force or is not willing to be tough enough in the defense of America. In fact, if you think back to 2004, I remember this very well. At the Republican convention in 2004, both Dick Cheney and Rudolph Giuliani explicitly argued that the fact that George Bush was unpopular in Europe was proof that he was standing up for American interests, and that was kind of a test. And Republicans, I think, would be very quick to try to argue that Obama, and have argued at times, that Obama, in effect, would compromise American interests to play to the global crowd. Certainly, there was a little bit of covering yourself against that here, but I think this is genuine. I think there is a realism here. I would sort of counter Jack a little bit on that, and I think that, you know, what he is saying, and I think what he said very clearly in his Afghanistan Afghanistan speech is, you know, you have to weigh the costs and benefits of all of these choices. You may have imperfect choices and in some cases no good choice, but that you have to kind of face the world as it is. And that, I think, was the core line in the speech.
Ezra, you know, we've heard Pat Buchanan celebrating this speech. Some have said George W. Bush could have given this speech with his talk about evil and the strength of arms. And, you know, you can't negotiate with Hitler. You can't negotiate with Al-Qaeda. Could George W. Bush have given this speech on its content?
Quite a bit of it. I mean, Bill Kristol over at my newspaper here wrote a blog post on our blog Postpartisan where he simply put quotes of Bush and quotes of Obama next to each other, and they were very similar in many ways. And this was also, don't forget, the through line of commentary after Obama's Afghanistan speech a week ago or 2 weeks ago, that people said, you know, I like that speech better when Bush gave it. And I think that what you're seeing here is that Obama, in part because of the decisions of the Bush administration, right, wars do not reset every 4 years, is boxed into making many of the same decisions the Bush administration would have made. At this point, you know, winning the Afghanistan war is maybe not – I mean, I don't know if bipartisan is exactly the right way to put it, because I think there are people in both parties who would like us out. But it is not a partisan move forward any longer. And so I think that you are seeing that when you're making a single decision, there aren't that many different ways to rhetorically justify it. You have to share you have to share justifications and good lines and good arguments with the administration that came before you.
Jack, I wonder, we just have 20 seconds here, but what some of the Europeans in that audience may have been thinking about the man who they garlanded here.
Give us back that prize.
Where's Gandhi? Where's King?
When we needed him. Yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, to me, Ezra rightly talks about the echoes of Bush. And the major echo to me is the lexical straitjacket of war, talking about the fight against Al-Qaeda as a war rather than an international police action. I think that lexical dead end is continuing to haunt us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a week in the news, climate and Copenhagen, the president and the Peace Prize, congressional Democrats, and a health care compromise, maybe. Ron Brownstein is with us from Washington, political director and writer for the Atlantic Media Publishers, columnist for the National Journal, author of The Second Civil War. Ezra Klein joins us from Washington as well, blogger and reporter for The Washington Post, and our own Jack Beatty is here. Let's hear from our listeners. Tom in Beacon, New York. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to speak to the issue of Obama and war and peace. I have a background and credentials in the anti-war movement and was arrested in the civil disobedience against the Iraq War. But
okay.
I'm very much in favor of his Afghanistan policy, and I want to put the lie to the idea that this is a change for the president. This is, and that there is a large segment of the progressive community that supports the notion of just war and wars that are not seen as neoconservative adventures.
So do you see Afghanistan as a just war, Tom?
I do, very much so, and I think a large segment of the progressive community that supported this president in the campaign and has supported him in the last year in a lot of the progressive efforts that he's made legislatively, on climate change and the directives with the EPA fit very nicely into this worldview.
So a peace camp caller on board with the just war words out of Oslo. Tom, we've got it. Let's go across the border from New York to Montreal, Canada. Fred, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I thought you made an interesting point that the president made a kind of a political speech, but I think it was almost like a panegyric or a praising of the war and stating a case in favor of the war. And I thought that that was a very inappropriate form. And at Oslo, while he's receiving a prize to praise conflict, and I think it diminished and depreciated the significance of the Peace Prize.
So not exactly the right note for you. Ezra Klein, thank you, Fred. Ezra Klein, what do you expect here from the peace camp? First of all, our caller Tom says, hey, we're on board. We're progressives. He's progressive. You know, we understand what he's up to. And yet there has been a lot of pushback against Afghanistan before the speech last week at West Point.
I think we'll have to wait. I mean, I think you look back to Bush, right, and you look back to the days after 9/11, and, you know, the rhetoric was sound, and many people supported the war and certainly more supported Iraq when it began than in 2005 or 2007. Barack Obama's expansion of the mission in Afghanistan will be remembered as a success if it is one. If it isn't, then all the fine rhetoric, then all the just philosophy in the world won't save him. And, I mean, this is going to be a very, very hard situation for him because fundamentally this isn't nearly as much in the president's control as the president would like it to be, that once you're in a war, you want to win it. But he didn't really have control over the context of the war that he's in, neither beginning it nor the first, whatever, I believe, 8 years of it. So, you know, I think this will have to be remembered, you know, based on the outcome, not on the initial justification.
A slim majority of Americans in a New York Times poll this week, CBS New York Times found supporting that war, but just by a whisker, Jack.
Just by a whisker, and there's been a steady decline in Democratic support for the president. According to the latest Quinnipiac poll, Democrats now wrong direction 58%. Just in September, they were 71%. Well, one of the things that's happened in the meantime is the escalation in Afghanistan, and I think that we see the president praised by Sarah Palin and praised by Pat Buchanan. It remains to be seen whether this will not turn off a good many of his core supporters.
We'll see. Of course, there was evolution on the sort of national understanding of the Afghanistan engagement this week as well, as Secretary of Defense Gates was speaking out and General Stanley McChrystal, the top commander there, defending President Obama's orders and supporting them for a troop surge in Afghanistan. But here's an interesting exchange. I mean, last week, the theme was sort of we're surging in, but then we're getting out or beginning to get out in July 2011. This week, it's kind of not so fast on that. Here's a House Armed Services Committee hearing exchange on Tuesday. General McChrystal sparred on a troop withdrawal date with Representative John Klein, Republican of Minnesota. July 2011 was suggested as a beginning of withdrawal by President in his speech at West Point. Here's General McChrystal first.
I did not recommend that date, but I did identify to my leadership that I felt that in about 18 months, about the summer of 2011, that we thought we could make significant progress against this insurgency.
I understand. Excuse me, but you didn't recommend that such a date be put out there and announced. I just want to be clear about
that. No, Congressman, I did not.
No, I did not. And Secretary Gates this week saying, don't get too excited about July 2011. Ron Brownstein, what about the exit part of the strategy that the president outlined at West Point just days ago?
Well, before we get to the exit, can I just go back? I really want to disagree with the emphasis of both Jack and Ezra on the continuity between Obama's two speeches and Bush. If we are saying that acknowledging that al-Qaeda is a threat or that we have a national interest in preventing a Taliban taking over in Afghanistan and potentially providing basis to them, if that is a concession to conservative thinking, I think the Democratic Party is in a lot of trouble. In fact, in both speeches, it was a very different operation. Vision of how you move forward. In the Afghanistan speech, there was much more talk about tailoring ends to means, balancing costs and benefits than you would have ever gotten under President Bush. And certainly in the Oslo speech, the emphasis on working with international institutions was very different than anything you would have heard from President Bush. The idea that President Bush could have given that speech, and I'm not saying either of you said that, but others have, I think is silly because, I mean, what Obama is accepting, as any American president would, the reality as visited upon us as recently as 2001, that there is evil in the world that we have to be vigorous in confronting. But his means of doing that, his vision of how you do that, the way he defines the conflict, he has in fact retired the phrase war on terror essentially from the administration, I think is very different from Bush, and it does no one a service to kind of overstate the similarity there, either side, really.
Let's listen to a little that may go to that theme. I mean, this is certainly no jumpsuit on the deck of an aircraft carrier. Here was the president again in Oslo saying, you know, this is not glorious.
The instruments of war do have a role to play in preserving the peace. And yet this truth must coexist with another, that no matter how justified, war promises human tragedy. The soldier's courage and sacrifice is full of glory, expressing devotion to country, to cause, to comrades in arms. But war itself is never glorious, and we must never trumpet it as such.
Ezra Klein, a departure from George W. there?
You know, I think it's a bit more complicated of an issue, right? I think that Ron is absolutely right to say that this is not necessarily partisan. But then part of my point was that it wasn't with Bush either. The Iraq War was supported by a substantial number of Democrats, both in Congress and in the country more broadly. And much of what Bush did was consensus. It was outside of that that it became more complicated. There was much in Obama's speech, and particularly in the second half, which is really a vision of how the world's single military superpower should use its strength, that Bush couldn't have given because it was a vision of strength through restraint. It was a vision of America being a more powerful nation when it ensures that its power is legitimate. But at the same time, I do think that we are in a situation here where you would not have seen a very different path on Afghanistan if the Bush administration had had a third term, actually. And I think the reason for that is that if you want to win the war in Afghanistan, there probably aren't a lot of other options here. So whether or not the two have different intentions, and I believe that they do, and I believe that Barack Obama would prefer not to be facing a number of these issues, the sort of underlying point here is that at this point, the logic of war is its own logic. That this may be less about the president than about the situation. That's going to be a very tough thing, I think, for Barack Obama, who's going to be judged on consequences and situations that he frankly did not choose and didn't necessarily see another way out of.
We've got more to move to here, but Jack, let me just get you on that. A new American consensus represented in this speech or not?
I don't think so. I don't think there's a new American consensus on, say, Afghanistan, perhaps on lofty goals and on rhetorical formulations of ideal types in international relations. Sure, I thought the speech had all sorts of noble and sound points. But Afghanistan, as you say, just a bare majority supporting this policy. And now this is starting out. This week we had the Afghan president talk about substantial international support. He meant financial. He could also mean military. Up until 2024, where he got that number, I don't know. Meanwhile, of course, we have our military instrument. Speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, General Petraeus said, "Our army has been in a state of mobilization and or active military engagement since 1990, every year." And, you know, there's an end on that. And I think that that end is that the issues with the army, the issues with wearing out our forces and the tenebrous issues surrounding the corruption of the government in Afghanistan and the Pakistan issue, I think all of this is going to vex exceedingly. It's going to be a steady erosion of support for this war.
Maybe, but I don't see that end. Cindy, Point Huron, Michigan. You're on the air, Cindy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I think the war in Afghanistan is a war that we should have been fighting in the first place. We've wasted 8 years in Iraq, and I think that we need to get on with Afghanistan. Other than that, I'm anti-war. I have been all my life. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Cindy. That's a big other than that, but that's where we are right now. I want to turn to healthcare if we can. We've got a lot on our plate here. Ezra Klein, tell us what happened this week. What's the turn that Democrats are taking from public option to something else, something around Medicare style?
It's a bit hard to say even for them at the moment. What we have right now, just to set up the situation, Harry Reid has sent details of a potential compromise or potentially a number of compromises to the CBO, but he has not told anybody what he has sent. So to just sit here for a minute, we're talking about leaks, rumors, hearsay, things that senators think is going on, and these details could change when we know for sure. But what we believe is happening are two primary things. One is that there's no more thing called the public option. There is, in replace of it, two different pieces of a compromise. One is a series of national nonprofit options that would be there to mimic the role the public option would play in getting profit out of the system a little bit and creating sort of national insurance options where most are state-based right now, so there's more of a sense of scale. These would be privately
run. Is that the coverage like members of Congress has? Is that what the reference is there?
It is. They all actually have Blue Cross Blue Shield pretty much. Their coverage, we expect it to be very good, but actually it's very standard. But this will be regulated by the Office of Personnel Management, which are the same people who regulate what the members of Congress get, which is why they're able to say same as we get. But so that is one piece of it, but not the piece liberals are actually that excited about. Mm-hmm. The other piece is Medicare buy-in, which is if you're 55 or over, you can decide to pay for Medicare, and you don't have insurance, you don't have an employer insurance. If all those conditions are met, you can go and cut a check to Medicare. And the reason that's actually pretty important is that Medicare, because it is so large, is able to bargain much lower prices with doctors, hospitals, everyone else. And we tend to think that Medicare is about 20% cheaper than private insurance. Mm. This is why the original public option, which would have been partnered with Medicare, was terrifying to many hospitals, doctors, insurance companies. This would be much smaller. It's only for 55 to 64, but it would actually be much stronger. And you are now seeing a backlash emerge because people, in the industry are looking at this and saying, if people begin to see how much more you get from Medicare for your premium dollar, that may be really the beginning of a slippery slope. Right now, you don't know what Medicare is giving because you move into that, you don't pay premium dollars. But if you do, that's mm-hmm. an apples to apples comparison, and it won't rebound well for the insurance industry.
Ron Brownstein, why are the Democrats leaning toward these new avenues? And what's the Republican word here now? Is this the back door to national coverage?
The Republican word is the same that it has been. No. It hasn't really changed much. I was thinking as Ezra was talking that James Carville famously said in the first Clinton administration that when he dies, he wants to come back as the bond market. I think now you want to come back as the Congressional Budget Office because it has become the Oracle of Delphi to which everyone in Washington, kind of makes offerings.
Yes.
Genuflecting. You bring your offering and you hope they come back with a positive sign, smoke in the chimney kind of thing. And say you can go forward. What you're facing here is a couple realities. The overriding reality is that we have now moved into a circumstance where you need 60 votes to do anything significant in the Senate as a matter of course. We have fundamentally amended the Constitution in slow motion. There have been more cloture votes, votes to end filibusters in this Congress so far this year than there were in the entire decade of the 1960s, just as a point of fact. And we are heading toward this being the second most ever cloture votes in a Congress in American history, exceeded only by the previous Congress of 2007-2008. So when you need 60 votes to do anything, and the opposition party votes against you en masse now in a quasi-parliamentary way on everything, you are forced into some tremendous kind of gyrations trying to get a supermajority. Tom Daschle said to me recently that we have a parliamentary system without majority rule, which is a very difficult combination in which to govern. And you can see the strains on this as Democrats are forced into ever more complex balancing acts and moving a little here, moving a little there, trying to get to 60 votes. One quick final thought. Mm-hmm. I wonder on some of these issues, if you think back to your middle school math, maybe that on some of these issues, the Venn diagram never encompasses 60 votes. If you move your policy solution 5 degrees to the right and you pick up Joe Lieberman, maybe you lose someone else in the Senate or you lose the House liberals. When you need a supermajority to govern and you really cannot get any votes from the opposition party, that is a very difficult circle to square. And we are seeing the challenge of it on what has been intrinsically the most difficult issue, domestic issue for American presidents. It has defeated health care, has defeated every president who's tried it, Richard Nixon, Harry Truman, Bill Clinton. Democrats are closer than anyone's ever been, but you see the complexity of trying to govern with 60-vote requirement.
Parliamentary style almost. Jack Beatty, do you see that reform coming before Christmas, as we heard Nancy Pelosi say at the top of the hour here? Do you see a win, a reform of some kind?
She wants that under the tree. I think they're going to have to deliver. I really do. I think it's a political imperative for the party. However, I think they're clearly fighting public opinion. 61% in today's CNN poll are against what they understand to be the program. Yet at the same time, in the Quinnipiac poll, by nearly 20 points, the public wants the public option. So what does the Senate do? It drops the public option. There's something, this system that Ron, I think, was very well describing of almost a Ptolemaic universe where epicycles have to keep being substituted in order to make this thing work. It's not selling with the public, and the Democrats aren't delivering what the public seems to want.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Big snow, American jihad allegations, and Orrin Hatch on Hanukkah this week. Five Americans detained in Pakistan were allegedly looking to join al-Qaeda. Here's a Pakistani official.
They had U.S. passports, valid passports with valid Pakistani visas, and they were here for jihad.
A powerful winter storm slammed the Midwest. Weather broadcasters everywhere having a field day.
Thousands of people have lost power, highways have been shut down, and millions of Americans are in the grip of a blast of wintry weather.
And the musical Orrin Hatch, Republican senator and Mormon of Utah, has written a new song celebrating Hanukkah, which begins tonight.
Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah, the festival of light. In Jerusalem, the oil burned bright.
Orrin Hatch, rocking out on Hanukkah. We're talking about a week in the news. Climate, Copenhagen, the president, the Peace Prize, congressional Democrats, health care compromise, and then we're movements on jobs and maybe another stimulus in the pipeline. Let's get a call from St. Louis, Missouri, and Steve. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing?
Well, what do you see, Steve?
I'm surprised and a little disappointed. They keep on talking about spending stimulus money to help small business. I don't understand why they just don't get rid of the government red tape, which is strangling small business. The system we've got set up creates monopolies and destroys small competitive businesses.
And, so you don't want government help on credit or on stimulus or any of that, Steve?
Well, I'm not saying I'd rule that out. That's, you know, an area that I'm not expert in. But I do know that small businesses are really being hurt by the red tape that they're forced to go through, and there's no real reason for it.
Red tape, credit crunch, it was very much in the news this week, what to do about getting the economy really going. The president, apart from Peace Prize speeches, was at the Brookings Institution on Tuesday. He said there that despite its unpopularity, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, is expected to cost taxpayers $200 billion less than originally anticipated. He said TARP funds should be used to help those outside the banking system.
This gives us a chance to pay down the deficit faster than we thought possible and to shift funds that would have gone to help the banks on Wall Street to help create jobs on Main Street. Small business, infrastructure, clean energy. These are areas in which we can put Americans to work while putting our nation on a sturdier economic footing. And that foundation for sustained economic growth, that must be our continued focus and our ultimate goal.
The president on Tuesday, Ezra Klein, you hear Steve in St. Louis say government no thanks, and yet, you know, everybody wants the economy to get revved up more than it is. What's coming this week on the economic pump it up front from the government, if anything?
Not enough, frankly. I think actually people should read Paul Krugman's column today on this, which I think is very, very eloquent. And he makes the point that we've begun to convince ourselves a sort of a mixture of fatalism and depression about the economy that, you know, we're coming sort of out of the funk, but we're just going to be at a period of double digit or very high unemployment for years, and we don't need to be. This idea that we're going to move TARP money back to the deficit is a terrible idea right now. It's actually a mixture of a bad idea and a not totally honest idea. Because of the way TARP money is scored, the Congressional Budget Office looks at not how much we've spent, so not the $700 billion, but how much it will cost us, which is very little because most of that money will be paid back by the banks. So it's actually not much money going to the deficit, which makes it a sort of a good applause line, I guess. But the deficit right now is not the problem. The reason you worry about the deficit is that it pushes up the bond market. It makes it hard to borrow. Interest rates go up. This is a whole Clinton thing from the early 90s. And they were right, but not now. Bonds are very, very low. Interest rates are very, very low. And the problem is the economy is just very, very slack. We actually need much, much more stimulus. And though I'm glad to see the Obama administration coming out with more on jobs, it's not nearly enough. And the big move now needs to be, and probably won't be, unfortunately, from the Federal Reserve. But watch Bernanke's hearings for more on this, because the fundamental question right now is whether the Federal Reserve, which is the force that really could do something about employment in this country, is going to be willing to step forward from its traditional role as being sort of the guardian of inflation and move to the role that's actually in its charter, which is guarding full employment.
We'll talk about what they might do. Of course, Republicans pushing back. Here's House Minority Whip Eric Cantor, Republican, Virginia, responding to the Obama speech on Tuesday.
I think at the end of the day, though, there is a stark contrast between what the president is proposing and our no-cost jobs plan. In fact, he said that he challenged us to bring in economists to make the case that we ought not be spending right now. We think that we've spent enough. We think that spending money we don't have brings uncertainty. And in fact, small and large businesses have reacted to that and have a whole lot of hesitancy about job creation.
Ron Brownstein, where do you see this coming down? More spending on stimulus one way or another, or not?
Yeah, I think there will be more, not as much as people like Ezra and Paul Krugman want, but obviously I think we are heading toward more. The Democrats are facing a very difficult and complex political environment. There's no question. I mean, on the one hand, I think Ezra's right that as an objective analysis, unemployment at 10% is clearly a bigger problem for the country than the deficit today. On the other hand, there is a tremendous amount of evidence that big chunks of the particularly the white middle class are moving in a Ross Perot-esque direction in which skepticism about Washington is crystallized into concern about the deficit. And in some ways that is driven by the sense that the people at the top have made out like bandits in the effort to respond to this recovery, while those in the middle and below have not. In some ways, Goldman Sachs is to American politics in this decade what the welfare queen was in the 1980s, the symbol of federal profligacy and taking money from my pocket, giving it to someone who doesn't deserve it. So they, I think, it is understandable, I think, that they feel they have to respond to both of these concerns, because you have a lot of Democrats in marginal areas, more conservative areas, that really do feel they need something they can go home with and say, look, maybe not now while the economy is so slack, as Ezra says, but we have to show you we have some pathway to bring these deficits back under control to some extent. And there's a lot of pressure from those red state and red district Democrats for something they can bring home for this 2010 election.
Let's go to that point with Mike in Charlotte, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because I think that with the with Britain and France currently going in the direction of putting a heavy surtax on the bonuses that bankers have gotten.
Yes.
Bank CEOs.
Mm-hmm.
I think and Germany, it sounds like, is considering the same thing. I think the U.S. should also do that. I mean, these guys making millions and millions of dollars while a lot of people are out of work. In the meantime, they're the ones that basically created the economic mess that we're in right now.
Mike, the big shots at Goldman Sachs clearly want to dodge that bullet. They're saying yesterday, that the top 30 earners there are not going to have cash bonuses, but rather stock bonuses that would pay out over more time. Would that be good enough for you, Mike?
Well, I think that we need to generate some more revenue for the U.S. government, and I think taxing people that make over $1 million a year, at a higher rate of tax is certainly justified.
Jack, you're going to line up with London and maybe Mike there and bring out a special tax for the big bonus crowd?
I'd like to see it, but I don't think you will see it from this administration, just because one of their successes is they have got market confidence. You know, I mean, that has been something they have delivered. The stock market is back. People are, the 401ks are doing better, and that's part of their sort of give Wall Street what it wants. And I think the personnel of the administration, I can't imagine Secretary Geithner favoring such a thing. So I think it's averse to the administration's policy position.
One more on the economy front. Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, you're on the air.
Well, I'd hate to lay some more oil on this, but the most irritating snap of this week was Geithner's imperious tone with Congress, saying it's imperative that we extend a TARP till October, when all it's done is had the Wall Street trading like mad, not creating jobs, and that's how the profits come in. And the thing with Goldman Sachs, they're going to give them the money in the back door through bonuses, or in 5 years it'll be mea culpa for giving you not enough money 2 years ago, and I don't trust any of that. So Geithner on the stand looked just like Paulson to me, and it really irked me.
Ezra Klein, how about Timothy Geithner's durability in his position? I mean, he's got plenty of detractors these days. The market's back, there's some stability there, but still a lot of unhappiness around banks and bank policy. Is Geithner look long for his job?
I think he is very strongly supported within the administration, but I think that he actually is in more trouble than people might realize. The fundamental problem here is that Geithner did, I think, what he probably had to do, and at the height of outrage, he protected the banks. And he protected the banks because he felt that they were necessary. Their stability and safety was necessary to get the economy back on safe footing. But in protecting the banks, in never sort of giving the public an outlet for their absolutely justified anger, it essentially transferred that anger onto him, because now nobody can really touch the banks. They're too strong again. They're too safe again. They're giving too much money to Congress. And so the people who need pretty much a scalp to bring home to their constituents are looking at Geithner, and they're going after him. I mean, you heard this in the hearings, I believe it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, where congressman after congressman was asking him if he would resign. And so I think that they're in a tough position right now, because I think Geithner actually did a very, very, very good job. But he is a symbol of something the American people truly hate now, which is that the banks got off scot-free. And you do wonder, and I'm not saying this is fair, and I'm not saying it is a just summation of the job he's done, but you do wonder if he's going to continue to be the guy, if he will have the political legitimacy to begin the phase of rebuilding as opposed to the period of crisis management.
We're going to dive in big on the negotiations in Copenhagen on Monday, but I want to get a sense of what has unfolded there in the first week so far right here today. Here's a little tape from an environmental activist in Copenhagen, Ashwini Prabha. This is an activist from Fiji, island nation, note that, telling reporters on Tuesday this week that richer countries needed to take responsibility for their actions at the Copenhagen Climate Summit.
These countries cannot be ignorant because they don't see what the impacts in our lives are. They cannot just go for a treaty that's unambitious and that's not legally binding, because that means they will basically do nothing.
Can't do nothing, says the rep from Fiji. And who wouldn't understand that? The Danish minister presiding over the Copenhagen conference, Connie Hedegaard, said that many positive steps have already been achieved. Officials there are keen to make sure that some kind of progress, or the appearance of progress, takes place.
The truth is that the Copenhagen deadline already works. In recent weeks and months, many developed countries have announced economy-wide emissions reductions. And many developing economies have indicated ambitious national actions as their contributions to the global effort. China, Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, Singapore, Indonesia, a few days ago India, and last night South Africa, just to mention a few. Every positive announcement will improve our chances of staying below the 2 degrees Celsius target.
The Danish minister saying it's going to work here in Copenhagen. Let's get a call from Ithaca, New York. Emma, you're on the air.
Hi. You sort of have been answering my question now with 8 minutes left to go in your program. I wondered why nobody is talking Copenhagen. None of the corporate medias that I'm aware of talk about Copenhagen, including NPR News.
Not enough. You want more. And I can well understand that. I mean, there's a big appetite out there. Ron, what do you make of coverage of Copenhagen, of the substance of Copenhagen this week? We'll give it more attention next week, Emma, I promise you. But, Ron, what do you see coming out of Copenhagen so far, and is it getting the weight it deserves?
Well, let's see. In the corporate media of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the National Journal, Politico, they're all there and they're all reporting. So I don't know if that's really the real issue here. The real issue is how difficult this is, both domestically and internationally, to come to a consensus on something as fundamental as the way we use energy. There is evidence of movement, insufficient movement, but nonetheless, the Chinese have begun to engage the process. And when you talk to people in the administration, I mean, they feel that the Chinese offer of slowing emission growth as a percentage of GDP is not the final offer, that the China will not want to be isolated at the end, and that there is the opportunity here. And don't forget, we are talking about a two-stage process where Copenhagen is supposed to set the broad parameters, but actionable in an actionable way, and then a final agreement next year that only then brings you back to the challenge of, again, getting 60 votes in the Senate. John Kerry, Joe Lieberman, of all people, and Lindsey Graham this week announced the framework of their proposed compromise, which would expand some domestic production and promote nuclear at the same time that it limited carbon emissions. But it's not clear many Republicans will come on to that. And whatever happens in Copenhagen, the president will still face the challenge again of finding 60 votes, a supermajority, to do this domestically, or else rely on the regulatory authority of the Environmental Protection Agency, which is moving forward, but also faces the hurdles and the landmines of almost certain litigation.
Ezra Klein, a lot of passion in Copenhagen. Do you see it lining up? I mean, it was originally supposed to produce the thing itself, the agreement itself. Now it's to line it up for next year. Do you see it lining up in an effective way for action globally, action in the USA?
You know, it was a big move that Obama's going to come in at the end, and it was very important that China brought out its own sort of emission caps in the week before. But the real problem we have is that the problem of global warming is far outpacing the politics. I mean, in America, actually, this year, we've seen an intense backslide in the belief that global warming is a problem. It was up near 70, and now it's down near 50. I think that's even just in the global warming is real, forgetting whether or not we need a new tax on energy to price carbon efficiently. And I think that people who, you know, in Copenhagen, generally speaking, are really scared, and correctly so. I think that, you know, Nancy Pelosi did a smart thing by passing that cap and trade bill when she had the votes, because she would not have the votes to do it now. But as Ron says, you need 60 in the Senate, and the president needs to go to the international community with something that is strong enough for them to feel like they should make moves too, but that is fundamentally that he's not really sure that he can get in the Senate. So do I think Copenhagen is doing well? Frankly, I think that the international community is doing a whole lot better than America on this. But broadly speaking, this is just a really tough issue, because it is, in one crucial respect, unlike healthcare reform or financial regulation. You can't just make this a bit better and then come back next year. Within a fairly short period of time, we hit a couple tipping points where we don't have enough ice in the Arctic and, you know, a couple other things. Carbon sinks open up. And then you can't solve the problem anymore, not unless you invent something to suck carbon out of the air. So you can't do a bit. You have to actually do enough. And the politics aren't there for enough yet. I mean, it's a very, very depressing issue.
Though a lot of emotion and a lot of will in Copenhagen. We'll be all over it on Monday to dig into the negotiations going on there and who stands where. Grateful to each of you for being with us in this hour. Ezra Klein with The Washington Post. Great to have you with us today, Ezra.
Thank you.
Ron Brownstein, always great to have you, sir. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack, have a great weekend. We're going to go out with little Danny Kay here, upbeat on Copenhagen, that old Danny.
Great. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Today, singing.